This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When you compare us with other states, Vermont does pretty well in overall health rankings. For example, we're near the bottom when it comes to the percentage of adults who are overweight and obese. But if instead of just looking at favorable comparisons, we actually take a look at how many people in Vermont are dealing with significant weight issues and the attendant health problems, the statistics are pretty dire. 1 in 4 Vermont adults is obese. When we look at how many Vermonters are overweight, that number grows to more than half. Some people are comfortable with their weight, but many people struggle to lose it, to keep it off, and to maintain a good body image and a healthy lifestyle. Recently, the results of a multi-year study of contestants who participated in the reality TV show The Biggest Loser were published, and they made a big splash. The simplified synopsis is that researchers report that most of the participating contestants have regained a lot of the weight they lost while they were on the show. But the bigger issue is that these people seem to have a significantly decreased metabolism compared to when they started their weight loss program. That's important because a lowered metabolism means you burn fewer calories, so you need to continue to have a restricted diet to maintain that lowered body weight. Other recent articles have questioned whether exercise is really an important component of weight loss. This leaves the hundreds of thousands of overweight Vermonters and millions around the country wondering what to do. Today on the program, we're joined by Dr. C. Lawrence Keene, professor of pediatrics and medicine at the University of Vermont College of Medicine. His research focuses on the links between diet, metabolism, obesity, and disease. Dr. Keene, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thanks a lot. After hearing this program so many times, it's kind of interesting to,
be on the,
other
side.
Recipient end of it. Yeah.
Well, we're really excited to have you. And, you know, I think it would be nice to start off with sort of understanding what the landscape is, and then we can get into these questions of metabolism that have been so interesting for people and so many people reading these articles about, does dieting decrease metabolism long term? How do I maintain weight loss? How are hormones related? What about exercise? We're going to get into all of these questions. And listeners, if you have some questions of your own, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So what's the problem with being obese or overweight?
Well, first of all, there are data from now, it's I guess about 3 years ago now, from the CDC, and the risk of metabolic disease such as heart disease and diabetes is certainly related to overweight. But their data showed that people whose adults whose body mass index was between 25 and 30, which means they're sort of overweight, actually had a lower overall mortality risk than those who were thinner or leaner. And those in the 30 to 35 range actually were neutral in terms of their risk. So the people who are at most risk for metabolic disease and diabetes are those whose body mass index exceeds 35. So they're becoming extremely overweight. Of course, in the general population, body mass index is a measure of adiposity, how fat you are. But you need to remember that there are individuals, such as professional football players, who have body mass indices of 40 or more who have absolutely hardly any fat. So
it's sort of a rough tool.
Yeah.
You know, it's
a rough tool. And the degree of sort of fat mass, if you will, or adiposity is certainly a risk for a number of different diseases. But you also should bear in mind that probably less than 50% of people who are truly obese never develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. And we don't understand that exactly, but I am actually interested in that area. But, it means that we really don't fully understand how becoming obese causes these diseases, but we certainly have ideas. I certainly have ideas.
Well, what are your ideas?
Well, I think that first of all, you need to distinguish between how obesity causes what we call metabolic disease, heart disease and diabetes, from other physical problems that develop because people are obese. For example, sleep apnea, which is an obstruction of breathing that's particularly a problem at night, is associated with fat accumulation in the upper airway. And that is certainly related to being obese. And sleep apnea can cause sudden death at night. And it interferes with sleep. And so people actually are more at risk for being less active, for example, which is a vicious or positive feedback cycle. And a sleep apnea by itself, along with increased adiposity, increases what we call inflammation. It's often called sterile inflammation. Inflammation is the production of certain compounds, we call them cytokines, that have a lot of can have very adverse effects. They have adverse effects on how glucose is utilized by muscle. So if you can't sort of take up the glucose from your muscle, it rises in the blood. That causes the pancreas to have to secrete more insulin. And eventually, the pancreas perhaps can't keep up. And then the blood glucose no longer can be controlled, and you're said to have diabetes based on a high glucose concentration. Inflammation, which can originate from an increased adipose tissue mass, but in our work also appears to be related to high saturated fat diets, doesn't cause the level of sort of cytokines in the blood, the level of inflammation you see with infection. It's probably about 1/20th of that. That's why we call it sterile inflammation. But it interferes with the function of the muscle. It interferes with the function of the liver. Interferes with the function of the pancreas. And in our latest work, we're very interested in how it interferes with brain function, actually. And there's a risk for Alzheimer's and also just cognitive aging that happens as people get older, you know, not remembering things. They don't have dementia, but they have fluctuations in their brain function. So,
and that can be related to weight, to body weight.
It can be related to weight as well. And the adipose tissue is what we've learned in the last 20 years or so. It's true. It's a lot of fat droplets that are kind of sitting there. It's our way of storing energy. If you were a scallop, you would store your energy as glycogen. That's why scallops are sweet. But if you store a carbohydrate as your form of energy, it's very heavy and you can't move around. So mammals that move around, people store their energy as fat. So in part, the adipose tissue is just big droplets of fat. And yes, if they get up around your neck, they can interfere with breathing. I've had at least one patient who had so much fat in the abdomen that he couldn't breathe normally and was constantly falling asleep and turning blue until we were able to get him to lose some weight.
Huh.
But the adipose tissue also contains, it also produces many different compounds which can both, they can affect appetite, they can affect the insulin signaling, the ability of the muscle to respond to glucose, for example. And it can both, their compounds that both improve the function as well as make it worse. Leptin, for example, is an important compound that affects brain function, actually, but it's known particularly because it's necessary if it's functioning normally and reaching the brain in a normal fashion, helps suppress appetite. So that's
And this is one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because leptin is featured in some of the new reporting that's been coming out. And as you said, leptin is something that can suppress the appetite in a person. It can, you know, make you not feel like you are just famished. And some of the recent research, the research that I referred to that relates to the contestants in the Biggest Loser program, suggested that people who have lost a lot of weight see a very significant decrease in leptin, which makes them feel hungry all the time. So from what you know of your research, does that jive? Does that seem right, that the people who lose a lot of weight may have a decrease in this hormone leptin that is telling them, you are hungry, you are hungry, you are hungry?
It's complicated.
Isn't leptin, it always?
Yeah. No, but not that complicated to talk about. leptin was originally discovered as the protein that was missing in these genetic strain of mice. They're called OBOB, and they get very, very fat, and they have diabetes and lots of other problems. And it was completely missing from these animals, and so they overate. I had a patient, and others have had patients like this, who are unable to form adipose tissue. And they have very low levels of leptin as well. And they are at risk for diabetes, but they don't really eat too much. They don't have a lot of place to store fat. So it's a very complicated a molecule. In the brain, for example, besides suppressing appetite, it may, in fact, in normal people anyway, it may affect physical activity. And so it's you know, more and more is learning about it. Now, look, now in this study, this that you're referring to, the people start off with very high leptin levels, which is typical of obesity. Their levels are high, but the leptin is not reaching the brain in the normal amount, and there seems to be resistance to leptin, just like people who are obese have resistance to insulin.
So they have enough leptin in their bodies, but if you're saying it's not getting to their brain, it's not giving them the signal that says you're not really hungry.
Exactly. And it's not, you know, it's not as well understood as you like, because it's infecting the brain and it's difficult to study some of these things in the brain. These people, though, after they lost weight, and this was a very extreme weight loss. I mean, it was...
These are people who are losing 100, 150, 200 pounds.
I mean, yeah.
Exercising seven hours a day.
You know, I had a 17 or 18-year-old patient once who lost 100 pounds, but in a year, not, you know, 3 pounds a week maybe at first, but not a pound every day. Mm-hmm. So these people were losing a lot of weight. And their leptin level, on average, did go way, way down. And so I'm not surprised that they might have been hungry. I also don't know whether I would recommend that kind of extreme dieting. It's probably not the best way to lose that weight. So it did go way, way down. And then, you know, that was after 30 weeks of the competition, and then at 6 years, it was actually fairly high. I would say I looked at our own data of healthy people and a few obese people, and I'd say the average was about twice what we found in normal people. But there were those that we had that were not obese who had levels even higher. But in these people, at any rate, the level was slightly lower than it was before they started the diet. So leptin probably contributed it to their ability to eat more than they need. And that's very important to emphasize. On one hand, there was a fellow, Eric Ravison, who used to be at the University of Vermont. But when he was studying the Pima Indians in Arizona, he found that those who had very low metabolic rates, burning of calories in the resting state, had a much increased risk of obesity 5 years later. So it's important. It's the resting energy expenditure, which is not fully understood how you can actually control that, is a factor which sort of buffers your ability to eat more. So does training for a marathon every day. But ultimately, people become overweight because they're unable to control their appetite in relationship to their energy expenditure. And I think that probably relates to the fact that there hasn't been, we would call, a lot of evolutionary pressure on controlling appetite.
Yeah, I mean, we were designed to eat when we could and as much as we could, because, you know, in our evolutionary past, you wanted to gain as much, get as much food as you could to have that buffer for lean times.
I was reading this morning a paper by Jared Diamond, who's written a lot of popular books, and it was a very good physiologist whose work I knew about when he was doing mostly physiology. And he describes a population in the South Pacific who they lived in this little island, and they would have to go on these voyages, you know, with rowboats or whatever that they used, and they might be weeks coming back. And those who weren't obese didn't survive. So obesity, as we know it, was something that was kind of selected for in that population. And they even prized it. They kind of like the Rubin paintings of the 19th century, you know, it wasn't looked down upon. But then some things happened. And we don't need to go into the details, but a couple of things happened which caused them to be deprived of food. And then when they sort of found minerals on their islands, and they were very wealthy relatively to the rest of the world, they really, really became overweight and had a real epidemic of diabetes in a relatively short period of time. And now it seems to be declining. So there's a genetic basis for some of this, and certainly genetics plays a role in whether you become obese, and there's very good data to support that.
Well, we're going to talk more about that, as well as metabolism and how it's related to weight loss and weight maintenance. And we know that many of you have questions. We'll get to your calls and emails coming up. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Dr. C. Lawrence Keene is professor of pediatrics and medicine at the University of Vermont College of Medicine. His research focuses on the links between diet, obesity, and metabolism, and all of these complicated connections. That's exactly what we're discussing with him today, especially in light of recent news stories that have suggested that significant weight loss through dieting can lead to a long-term decrease in metabolic rates and a simultaneous change in hormones that makes people feel hungry all the time. Dr. Keene is wary of some of the recent research. We're looking at what his own research has been saying and what's known about weight loss and what you might be able to do if you're somebody who's trying to lose weight or thinking about losing weight. If you have a question about obesity, metabolism, exercise, and diet, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Walter, who's calling in from Ripton. Hi, Walter. Go ahead.
Hi. I lost 80 pounds about 10 years ago, and I did absolutely no exercise. It took about a year and a half, and I had no diet. I just started eating less and eating better food for me. And I went down to 185 pounds, and I've stayed about around 195 pounds. But didn't do any exercise. So basically, it's just the food I ate is what made me lose the weight.
Walter, thanks for sharing your experience, and congratulations on losing the weight and keeping it off. You know, that whole equation of calories in, calories out, is that really what's key here, Dr.
Yeah, King? I think that exemplifies a very important point. The authors of the paper that looked at the people in the competition are part of a group that it's hard to described simply, but there's a method that actually we've used in the lab in the past that can measure how much energy people are expending throughout the day while they're out about. You know, it's not in a laboratory. And that allows you also to assess how much people are eating. And looking at a large number of subjects who've been in various studies utilizing this technique, they have shown fairly well that in general in this country, people have become overweight because they're eating more, not because they're expending less energy. They found that as the body mass index increased, their energy expenditure increased. And they, as they say, if lowered energy expenditure or greatly deficient physical activity, for example, was the cause, they would have seen that as the body mass index went up, an expenditure went down, and it's not what they saw. So exercise if you want to do it, has a lot of value for a lot of reasons. It may improve your sleep. It may improve your cognition. That's something we're interested in.
Mental health.
If you're doing aerobic exercise, it improves your cardiovascular health. But I think your experience is quite consistent with the fact that overall, the problem with gaining weight is simply eating too much for what you happen to expend. I mean, it may be difficult to become obese if you're running, 20 miles a day. And I have a friend who used to do that, 10 miles in and 10 miles back in Boston. But basically, it's eating more. And I think that if you're going to diet, and dieting is still useful in people who are not very ill with being overweight, the sensible thing that you did is the most important one, because you're also, by improving your diet, hopefully, and by, let's say, I'm not saying what you ate, but, if people are drinking a lot of sweetened drinks and eating candy and very high saturated fat foods, these are doing a lot of potential damage to you, independent of what your body weight and your body fat is. So I think a sensible improving the diet is important in its own right. And as I said, maybe less than 50% of very overweight people ever develop diabetes. So it may well be that improving your diet without even changing your weight may actually make you a lot healthier. And the jury's out on that. Our interest is in saturated fat, so
yeah,
we look for all those connections.
Let me read you another question that we got from a listener who also has maybe the opposite problem from Walter at the moment. Judy says, I'm a 57-year-old female who up until about 45 was in great shape. Things started to go south after that age, especially during and after menopause. I began to gain weight. I'm now 5'6 at 180 pounds and have been ridiculously attached to sugars and carbs. Up to my mid-40s, I could eat anything I wanted without worry about weight gain. I have a physically active job, and I just don't understand what has happened. Is it hormonal? Is it a slowing of metabolism? Can any natural or prescription medication speed up my metabolism? What are the most effective ways to get away from carbs and sugar? Judy says, I'm another overweight middle-aged female, and I swore I would never end up like my mom, but voila, here I am, and there is too much of me.
I don't know of any pharmacological agents right now that specifically can be used to create an aversion, let's say, to sugar. I will say this, though. It's fairly clear over the last 20, 30 years in this country that the proportions, the portion size of what we call sweetened drinks has gone up. And that's been associated, at least, with the epidemic of obesity. And what's so special about these sweetened drinks? Well, first of all, the companies make them because they want to do it economically and make a greater profit. So they take corn syrup, which is relatively inexpensive, but it's tasteless. I mean, it's not sweet at all. And they modify it industrially so that now instead of glucose, which is what corn syrup is, it's now fructose. So it makes it sweet. And people are drinking larger and larger quantities of that. The problem with fructose as a sweetening agent and sucrose, which is glucose plus fructose, is that the fructose is not meant to get – it goes from the intestine to the liver where it doesn't get beyond that. It can't get beyond that because people who have something called fructosemia where they can't metabolize fructose, they get very ill. They get liver failure and, frankly, die. So fructose doesn't get very much outside the liver. A little bit does, but not much. As a result, fructose, unlike glucose, doesn't stimulate, apparently, the areas of the brain that are designed to let you say, hey, I've eaten something, I should stop eating. So I think there's a real danger in overeating these fructose-sweetened beverages. Now, we could talk about the various studies where they've looked at that. When I was a fellow in the Boston Children's 40 years ago, we were taught to take those drinks out of the diet of children. That they made a list of what they ate, and that's the first thing we used to stop. But I can't tell you that in any consistent way, we had a successful weight loss. And 40 years later, they're still studying that at the Boston Children's. But I think the data suggests that substituting milk or some other beverage and other foods for that is helpful. So avoiding problem foods, and in this case, it appears to be sweets and sweetened drinks.
And carbohydrates.
And carbohydrates. Well, I mean, there are carbohydrates and there are carbohydrates.
Yeah, yeah.
In parts of the world that are still very poor, there are places where people can't get enough to eat because their diets are these, I'm not an expert at all the vegetables, but these root vegetables and that are so high in fiber that they really can't get enough to eat. They don't get enough energy. So their problem is that, you know,
they don't get enough to eat.
So carbohydrates, which are resistant to digestion, resistant starches, go to the large intestine, we call the colon, where they can be metabolized and change the nature of the bacteria. And it happens to be an interest of ours, but an interest of a lot of people now, that changes in diet and perhaps in some unknown way, adiposity or obesity per se, alters the bacterial flora alters the so-called the composition of the bacteria in the colon. And that has many, many potential effects on the immune system, on inflammation, and on the brain. I just reviewed a long paper from a group on that. And I would say I wouldn't avoid carbohydrates. I mean, I think that complex starches, fiber, those kinds of carbohydrates are probably good for you for a number of reasons. But I would suggest cutting out the sugar and the candy if you can, or sweetened drinks, just the way people have to stop smoking. If that doesn't work, then I think probably approaches like they're using at UVM to try to stop smoking are probably necessary. But that gets into the sort of psychology realm of treatment that I wouldn't feel
comfortable addressing. But that's what's so interesting, Dr. Keene, is that it is so all connected, and all of this research now emerging about the connections between weight and healthy weight and brain function. As you said, things like dementia later in life is just fascinating. Let's get another call in here from Liz in Dannemora, New York. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I was pretty overweight in high school. I was like 230, but I'm kind of tall. I'm like 5'9", 5'10". And I dropped extremely through exercise and extreme dieting. I got down to like 160 or so. And I was tired all the time, and I couldn't exercise anymore. I was exhausted. And through the years, I gained all the weight back, and now I'm actually 260, and I'm, you know, 5'10", and I notice I have way more energy than usual, and a lot of it I've noticed, I used to only eat like one meal a day, and I just gained so much weight. But now I eat three meals a day. I snack as well, and I have so much more energy, and I'm so much stronger than I was before. And I am considered overweight, but I'm actually healthier. Like, my anemia's gone. All sorts of issues are gone, even though technically I'm considered overweight. But it's kind of part of it was me getting over my own physical issues and also recognizing that I'm healthy and, I don't know, despite like physical appearance, I guess. But I just wanted to kind of make that comment of just because I'm look overweight doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, people are unhealthy.
And Liz, do you feel like when you interact with your doctors or medical professionals that you get advice that feels to you helpful to your personal situation?
Yeah, sometimes I've had a new doctor here and there, and it's kind of like, you know, they look at my weight on the chart and they're just like, oh, well, you know, you have to cut down on the sweets. And it's like, well, I don't eat sweets. And then, you know, you go further into the physical thing, and they always tell me, it's like, yeah, well, you're fine. I'm turning 30, so I can see maybe down the line eventually my weight, my having issues with my joints and other things. But, I'm so physically active as it is now. I'm not sure if that would be an issue. That's kind of one thing that I'm curious about as well. But
yeah, Liz, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing from you and hearing your perspective. Dr. Keene, what's your reaction?
Yeah, and I'll try to be careful so that I'm not trying to diagnose you on the phone, you know. There are a couple of comments I would make. I mean, three, actually. I mentioned earlier about so-called metabolically normal obesity. Now, that doesn't mean in you or anybody else who has excess body fat that there isn't some, medical disadvantage, but it's quite possible to be even much more overweight than you, especially if you're young, and not have any discernible problems with the lipids or with diabetes. The second thing I'll mention is that this is something that was discussed in the paper about these people who participated in this competition. Generally, and they're the exception because of their 6 hours or whatever exercise they were doing every day. But generally, with a so-called balanced deficit diet where we just eat less, about 40% of the weight loss is what we call fat-free mass or muscle mass. Now, some of that is probably dispensable. If you weigh 260, maybe you need less leg muscle to walk around than if you weigh 150. But to an extent, people overlose lean body mass. I mean, we could go into the mechanism for that. It's quite well understood why that occurs. And it's almost like you would find it much more acutely with the flu when you quit eating. You can lose 10 pounds or more in several days. As soon as you feel better, you eat again. And the reason you gain weight back is because you're gaining all this muscle back. All this muscle back. And only 20% of muscle is protein. And so there's not a lot of calories involved, but you gain a lot of weight back. So when you acutely lose weight like that, especially if you're not, A, exercising all the time, and B, on a relatively high-protein diet, you are going to feel weak. In fact, you could get seriously weak if you lose too much muscle mass. The other thing that you mentioned, and I think this is relevant, but again, I want to stray away from any medical diagnosis. Probably 40% of young women who are of childbearing age, something like that, and it's even higher. It's probably particularly high in those who are athletes, have relatively low iron. They're sort of iron deficient. Now, there are a lot of debates about whether that's good and bad and how low of an iron you can have and still, but it's very prevalent in this country and very, very prevalent in adolescent and young adult females who are athletic. And iron deficiency, when it's severe, can cause anemia. That's what we think about. Your blood count's low. But actually, the earliest part of iron deficiency is weakness. It used to be that they would sort of test for it by doing exercise tests like we do in the lab for other reasons. So feeling, weak and not able to do your chores of the everyday, that could be because of loss of muscle mass, could also be because of iron deficiency. And iron, even though we're used to thinking of eating a lot and meat and so forth, iron is actually ubiquitous in the diet, as is a number of nutrients. And most people become iron deficient because they just don't eat enough. And so they become iron deficient. And besides feeling weak and not being able to exercise as well, it also affects the brain. And it's not just in little babies. It's also in adolescents. And so it's essential for normal sort of brain function. So these are some of the problems with dieting if it's not supervised.
And Liz sort of explained how her situation fit with what you're saying. We just have a minute left. But I want to ask you, because what it seems to me from reading a lot of the research about weight loss and the difficulties that people have losing weight, the difficulties people have keeping weight off for whatever reason, you know, it seems like the depressing truth is don't ever gain weight. Is that really the message that we have to be learning?
Yeah,
as I
told you, I spent a lot of time reviewing the paper that was the basis on this. And this morning I said, you know, the biggest problem is getting that overweight in the first place, because prevention is so much more important. And we have people at UVM who have a very active program in this regard. But I think most people would agree that when your BMI is that high as these people's was, and if they're having medical problems for sure, like diabetes, unfortunately right now surgical approaches are the only real effective approaches. And frankly, diabetes in some cases resolves within a few days. And it's a mystery. I've reviewed grants on this issue and nobody quite understands it. Hopefully there will be a day in the future when you don't have to have surgery. But there is no simple way to get the metabolism to work faster.
Wow. Well, Dr. C. Lawrence Keene is a professor of pediatrics and medicine at the University of Vermont College of Medicine. His research focuses on the links between diet, obesity, and metabolism. Fascinating to talk with you, Dr. Keene. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, why is a military school hosting a conference about local resilience in the face of global climate change? We'll fill you in next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This Friday and Saturday, Norwich University is hosting the inaugural Resilient Vermont Conference. The conference will focus on change, survival, and adaptation in the face of global climate change and other threats. Joining us now to talk a little bit about it are the conference's organizer, Rebecca Stone, and Norwich Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, Tara Kulkarni. Nice to talk with you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Jane.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
Rebecca, what is the aim of the conference exactly?
This is actually the first time since Tropical Storm Irene, or maybe ever, that we've pulled together all the different people working on resilience statewide. And by all the people, I mean folks from many different disciplines, those working to build stronger roads and bridges and infrastructure, to take care of our watersheds and water quality, to take care of vulnerable populations and make sure people are protected and that our communities are prepared. So first and foremost, this is a chance to get all of those people in the room, celebrate our successes and the ways that Vermont really has come together since Irene, and also talk about where we need to go in the future to be better prepared and to tackle whatever challenges are coming our way.
Professor Kulkarni, Vermont would seem to be somewhat at the mercy of the federal government, the international community, a lot of factors bigger than our state when it comes to something like climate change. What can the state and actually just even local communities and people do to affect change, or at least to prepare for it?
Well, I think change really starts with the self. So if we start at the really small local level, I think the ripple effects are what kind of carry us through any kind of global events. And climate change is, of course, a huge issue that not one person can take on. So I think by trying to make sure that we create the right kind of solutions that are sustainable and that we can embrace as a small community, are really the first steps in trying to address this problem.
And at this conference, I mean, it seems like that's part of what is being addressed, is looking at really like local steps, hyper-local. There are sort of hands-on activities. There are field trips to local things like Education for Sustainability at Northfield High and a walking tour of susceptible sites and recovery projects in Northfield. Rebecca Stone, why is that helpful to have those really local examples?
I think it's really helpful because many of the people coming to the conference are working at the local level, and they are looking for examples that they can adapt or replicate in their own communities. We want to give them a lot of ideas that they can take, they can integrate into the work they're already doing and run with it. At the same time, though, we are also really reaching out to folks at the statewide level who are supporting this work on the ground, from agencies, nonprofit organizations, regional planning commissions, et cetera. So it's very helpful for them to get a glimpse of what's happening on the ground, what's working and where the needs are so that they can better tailor their resources and assistance.
And it's not actually just climate change that you're looking at at the conference, Rebecca, right? I mean, you're also talking about other forms of instability like cybersecurity and how people might be having to deal with cybersecurity threats in the future.
Absolutely. There are a few specific threats we will be talking about. Climate change is first and foremost, since that is one of our biggest threats and hazards here in Vermont. But the idea of resilience is that we build strong and self-reliant communities that can respond to whatever challenge comes their way.
Professor Kulkarni, I understand you're working on a special type of research that I'd love to have you describe a little bit more in detail, because it sounds fascinating, and it's a special kind of concrete that actually does some water filtration.
Yes, it does. So it's called pervious concrete, and the idea is, of course, regular concrete will have water fall on it and run off and become a flood, potentially depending upon the size of the rainfall. But pervious concrete, I guess you can visualize it as a sponge in a sense with a lot of holes. And so water can infiltrate or move through this concrete instead of running over. And our research was trying to basically capture this water to some extent, filter it, and hold it. And I guess we were trying to attack at this problem with water, which involves flooding, which involves quality, and which involves drought, in a one-in-a-kind solution. So you would have this pervious concrete filter, which is preventing flooding by infiltrating the water, treating it through traditional filter media, and then storing it for potential use in the future during drought situations.
Well, how far along have you come in this research? Can we all buy it now?
Well, the idea was to try and get the prototype successfully working in the lab. And we do have a small site on campus where we wanted to try and implement somewhat of a small-scale, pilot-scale version of this. And ideally, we want municipalities and other private industries or private companies or whoever has a parking lot and a sidewalk and a need for water storage or has issues with flooding to kind of sign up and see if they could use this. And I think it's a few years down the road before we get to that point. But it's definitely an exciting part of research for us.
Is it more expensive, this kind of concrete? I mean, with the water filtration system sort of built into it?
It shouldn't be. I think in terms of cost, it's not so much about the cost of the concrete, but really it'll come down to being able to maintain the pervious nature of concrete effectively. And of course, with our winters in Vermont, we want to make sure that the freeze-thaw cycles don't affect the structural integrity of the concrete itself. We also want to make sure that the snowplows, don't kind of damage the surface of the concrete itself. So it's more related to maintenance and making sure people who maintain it are trained to do it right.
Rebecca Stone, is this the kind of project that is, you know, valuable even within the framework of a Resilient Vermont conference? That, you know, it seems like you are looking at hands-on things or ways that we can make changes rather than let's study things, let's talk about it. You know, it does feel like, at least in what I'm seeing, this this movement and the conference is to really get at solutions that are concrete.
Yes, exactly. Again and again through the Resilient Vermont Project, which has now been running since Irene, we've heard that people really want action. They are hungry to get to solutions that work on the ground, that address multiple benefits or challenges at once and give people real ways that they can make their communities safer, more walkable, more vibrant, more economically sustainable, and better places to live every day.
Yeah, you know, it's hard. I mean, I feel like the word resiliency is such a buzzword these days. It's like sustainability. It can mean a lot of different things, or it can sort of mean nothing. And, you know, I'm curious about how you think of it, because it is this word that just sort of is out there as like, let's just talk about resiliency.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I think it really is a buzzword, and in some ways has maybe replaced sustainability as the buzzword of the day. For us, it really does come down to being stronger and creating the kinds of communities that we want and that we value here as Vermonters. So when we talk about resilience, I think we're really talking about the ability as community members, as a state, to come together and address whatever challenges we're facing, whether it is climate change or economic shifts, demographic shifts, and to make great places that function, places where we can help our neighbors, places where we have the landscapes that we value so much, the ability to live and have the quality of life that we want.
Tara Kulkarni is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Norwich University. Rebecca Stone is the organizer of the Resilient Vermont Conference at Norwich University. It's this Friday and Saturday, and we have more information about the conference at vpr.net. You can click on Vermont Edition. Rebecca, Tara, thank you very much. It was such a pleasure to talk with you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us. And we encourage everyone to still register and join us this weekend.
Good. Yeah. And again, vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition if you want to do that and you don't have direct access to the link. Now, bathroom preferences have become a shorthand for the complicated debates over identity and rights that surround the transgender community. A federal guideline last week put out a message to all public schools in the country that they need to get this right for transgender kids. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at how Vermont schools are doing and what laws and policies are in place to protect and support transgender people, especially in Vermont schools. You can share your questions or your experiences by writing to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. And be sure to tune in for the live conversation tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance today from Jean Murphy. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.